Great. So, Genesis 37 and 38. Jacob, we've seen, or his name has been changed now to Israel again. Back in the promised land, he went back to Bethel, where he got right with God, and we spoke about all that last time. We saw that Esau moved away from him. He's not near his brother. Esau went to dwell down in Seir, which would be called Edom later on. And God, his people, is now separated again from the rest, and now he continues to follow the story of that messianic line, because the whole scripture, really, the whole Old Testament is really focusing on this line that will eventually come to Jesus Christ, the Messiah. And the focus now today is two of the sons of Jacob. Firstly, Joseph. Joseph is like the perfect son. He's like the good son. He's the choice of his father, and he is really the picture of Jesus Christ. But then, on the other hand, we see Judah, the other son. He is, in this chapter, not a great guy. And he is really the choice of God. And we'll get to that a bit later on, and we'll see. So tonight, I've just entitled it, The Chosen Son. And the first chapter is about Joseph. And we read there in verse 1 of chapter 37. Now Jacob dwelt in a land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the history of Jacob. So he's living in the promised land, the land of Israel, and this is the history. So now he starts laying out the history, and it says, Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. So the fact that he's 17 years old is a good indication for us, so it gives us a time marker. And he was with his half-brothers. And this was a difficult time in this family. It's a troubled family. Just think about this. 12 sons from 4 different wives with one father that they're trying to please. You could just imagine. I've got 2 sons, you know, and it's hard. I think about 4, you know, moms and all these sons from the different sides. And there's been this favorite structure already set up, even the way that he presented them to Esau. It's very clear who was his favorites. And so it's just not a great family to grow up in. So just imagine the rivalry and the competition. And it says, then Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. So Joseph has been the father's favorite son all along, from the beginning. Now he reports their bad behavior, and that obviously didn't go off so well with the rest of the brothers. He's Mr. Good Guy. But before you make him out to be a tattletale or a blabbermouth or whatever, I think there's much more to Joseph than that. If you look at his character and the rest of the Bible that we see him, there's nowhere else that you get this idea from him. He was a great son, possibly something his father asked him to do. We're going to see a bit later in verse 14 also. This is probably his father trusted him because he knew he was an upright boy and he knew he'll get a right report from him. And he sent him and he asked him to tell him what's going on because he trusted him. So he's not like a snitch. His brothers were dishonest. They were negligent with their father's flocks. They were really endangering the family because that was their whole income for the family. That was the prosperity of Israel in the land. And he was just being faithful with what his father asked him to do, you know. So he is the good guy. And if you're the good guy, it's hard and it's alone, you know, especially if you want to do what's right and everyone else keeps calling you goody two-shoes, you know, because you just want to do what is right. It's just a difficult place to be. I remember I was in primary school, you know, and when they chose the prefix or whatever, the first time after we've been chosen, you know, they took us aside and the teacher told me, you stand here outside the hall and you look at this area here and you make sure that nothing weird is happening here. And I'm like, okay, so I stood there and then he placed the guys all around the hall and they went inside and suddenly all the guys showed up here by me and I'm like, what are you all doing here? I was standing, looking, doing my job, and everyone's out. Are you crazy? Like, you know, you're supposed to do that. And I said, well, he told me to do that, you know, and I experienced that my whole life through, even later when I was working on the yachts. I told you guys about that. You know, you'd be working, and then the captain gives you a job to do, and then you do your job. But then the captain leaves, and everyone just sort of goes sit down. And I'm like, what are you guys doing, you know? And it's not a great thing, because everyone's always like, yo, who are you, you know, but you're just trying to do your job, you know, that you've been given to do. So I don't think Joseph was like a tattletale. I think he was just, he's still young. And I think he is just doing what his father asked him to do. So verse 3, it says, "Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age." And so obviously we know it was Rachel's son, and he was really a miraculous son in that sense because, you know, it took forever for him to get this son. But it was Israel's mistake, really, because he is the one who put him above all the other brothers. So I don't think it was Joseph's choice. Joseph was just sort of part of this thing that his father liked him more than all the others. It says, also, he made him a tunic of many colors. This tunic of many colors, there's been obviously a lot of talk about this. The words can suggest either it was maybe a kind of colored cloak that he had, but the better meaning is probably that it was a robe with long sleeves. In those days, you know, the workers had sort of like a shorter cloak that was short at the legs and it had short sleeves before working. But the masters, the work givers, they had like long robes with long sleeves and they would be walking around because they didn't need to work hard. And so he sort of gave him one of these robes with like longer sleeves, sort of putting him above all his brothers. A long sleeve coat. A way to set him like as the youngest brother, almost the youngest brother, to set him above all the others in charge of everyone else. And you can just imagine that no one liked that, you know. So whether it was colors or sleeves, the fact is this coat that he got him, this tunic, distinguished him from all the others. So his father put him on this pedestal, obviously, before everyone else. And so it wasn't Joseph's fault. And this obvious display of favor towards him was difficult for everyone. I think it was difficult for Joseph too. I mean, I'm sure he didn't want to be in that place where everyone was against him. Then in verse 4, it says, "But his brothers saw that his father loved him more than all his brothers. They hated him and could not speak peaceably to him." So this is what happened. Now this turns over, this envy and this whatever is happening in their hearts is turning over to hatred. It says they could not speak peaceably to them. I mean, it was so bad that they couldn't even say anything good to him, you know? That's just crazy. Imagine having 10 older brothers hating you. I mean, it's one thing if you have an older brother that's really nasty to you, but having 10 older brothers that hate you, that's a raw deal. And so you could say he was less than unpopular with them, you know? But verse 5 says, "Now Joseph had a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more." And no, so you can say, well, you know, he had a dream, so why did he go tell his dream to his brothers? Because I sincerely think that Joseph was just such an upright kid that he was without any guile, and he was just excited about the fact that God gave him a dream and spoke to him. And he was just like, hey, guys, and I mean, he wasn't trying to brag. I mean, a lot of people, even the, you know, some TV stories, whatever, portray him as this bragging. I don't think he was that at all. If you look at the rest of his character through the scripture, you don't get that idea from it whatsoever. I think he was just a kid that was excited about the fact that God showed him something in a dream, you know. And he maybe must have realized it wasn't a normal dream because, let us be clear, you know, that's not the normal way that God speaks to people. Normally, God speaks to us through his word. God can abnormally, supernaturally choose to speak to you through a dream or something, but normally we hear God through his word. So this was something he must have figured out that God is trying to tell him something. And he said to them, "Please hear this dream which I've dreamed. There we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. Indeed, your sheaf stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf." Well, obviously not a great thing to share with them, but he felt like, you know, it's sort of crazy. The situation is like, can you believe it? I had this dream and, you know, God showed me that mine stood up and yours all bowed down. You know, it's like not what they wanted to hear. This was not great, even though it's going to be the truth later on, we'll see. It says also there in verse 8, "And his brother said to him, shall you indeed reign over us? Or shall you indeed have dominion over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. It's like you almost think they couldn't have hated him more. They already hated him. And every time they hate you more and they hate you more, you know, just going from really bad to worse. It's like, so you think you're going to reign over us, you little brat, you know? And they're showing him, by saying that, they show that they actually understood exactly what this dream meant. I mean, they understood the meaning of all of this perfectly. And that's why they hated him more. Because God spoke to him a dream. And the thing is, when God reveals his plan and his work, all people aren't necessarily excited about that. You know, this is what God says I'm going to do. And he shows him beforehand. But the rest of them are not excited about it at all. They are actually just bitter against it. Then verse 9, then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, look, I've dreamt another dream. And so again, you know, maybe not a good thing, but I don't think you can fault him, because I think he's an excited kid that is just like, I mean, God speaking to me through dreams. And the thing is, we have to realize about Joseph, especially in this chapter, Joseph is a picture of the Lord Jesus Christ. He's a typology of Jesus. And so Jesus, think about it. Jesus had a miraculous birth. Joseph had sort of a miraculous birth because his mom was barren all the time. And then, you know, finally God gave her this baby. Jesus is loved and esteemed by his father. Joseph was loved and esteemed by Israel, his father. Jesus is perfect and he's set apart from sinners. And Joseph was sort of like a human kind of perfection. And he was set apart by his coat that he had. His coat set him apart from everyone else around him. So Jesus was hated by his brethren without cause, and Joseph was hated by his brothers because he had nothing to do with it. Jesus presented himself as Messiah, as the ruler, and Joseph here announces the fact that he is going to rule over his brothers. So he tells this dream. He says, look, I've dreamt another dream, and this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So crazy, right? This all happens, and this is what I saw in my dream. Like every one of you bowing down to me, and the sun and moon, you know, suggesting his father and his mother, you know. So this is a big thing to say. So he told it to his father and his brothers, and his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamt? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come and bow down to the earth before you? So his father is like, okay, now you're going too far. You know, and so he just sort of rebukes him in that. But think about, wasn't Jesus greater than his earthly father, his stepfather, Joseph, you know? Jesus was also greater and everyone bowed down to him. So it's just interesting to me, this whole similarity here and the fact that they are angry about this. Then verse 11, and his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. So his brothers were just like, man, you know, what's up with this kid? You know, he's put above us all. Now he gets the dreams and this dreams is not great. And now, you know, and his father, he thought about it because he thought, is there any significance to this kind of thing? He just silently, quietly in his heart thought, I wonder, you know, about this dream. Because the easy part is getting the revelation. This is really the easy part. You know, this is the fun part, the beginning, where God gives you the revelation. Now the hard part is being prepared for all the difficulty that's going to follow to prepare him for the plan that God has for him. I mean, Joseph had a hard life. We're going to look at that, you know, a bit further still in the scripture. But at this stage, you got the revelation. It's just all exciting. Yes, everyone's going to bow down before you. But what's going to happen now in the next 13 years of his life, you know, is going to determine his character and prepare him for the thing that God wants to do to bring him to that place. And so that is the hard part. 13 years of hard stuff happening to him to build his character so God can use him miraculously. And this dream that he gets even, you know, helps us to interpret things like Revelation. Revelation 12 verse 1 speaks about the great sign that appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. And we know that's the picture of Israel. So you can't come to Revelation and say it means the church or it means something else, because clearly here it is the picture of Israel. The best commentary on the Bible is the Bible. So we compare scripture to scripture and that's how we get the true meaning of it. So it even helps us with the last book of the Bible. Then verse 12, then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. Now that's like about 80 kilometers away. So that was far from where they were at the moment. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to him, here I am. Again, beautiful picture. I need you to go to them. And what does he say? Here I am. Jesus' father sent him to his brethren, just like Joseph's father now sends him to his brothers. And he says to him in verse 14, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks and bring back word to me. There you see, this is what his father expected of him. It's like you go and you go, look what's going on. You come and tell me what's going on. And so he was just being obedient to his father. So he sent him out to the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem, which is, like I say, about 80 kilometers far away, to do his father's work. Verse 15, now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering in the field. And the man asked him, saying, "What are you seeking?" So he said, "I'm seeking my brothers. Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks." And the man said, "They've departed from here, and I heard them say, 'Let's go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan. And so Dothan means two wells in Hebrew. So he finds this guy, he's wandering in the field. Guy's like, "What are you looking for?" He's like, "I've been looking for my brothers. They're supposed to be here." And he's like, "No, they left and they went over there." Verse 18. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. So this is crazy. They see him walking from a far distance, and they're like, they're not thinking like, "Let's get him and give him a wedgie or something." They're thinking, "Let's kill him, you know? It's like, we're going to kill him when he comes to us." They've already killed people by this time. And they say in verse 20 there, so they say, "Look, there's a dreamer is coming. Come, let us therefore now kill him and cast him into a pit, and we'll say some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what will become of his dreams." So the dreams is a big issue to them. It's a sensitive spot. You know, the dreams is something that sort of gets them. And the moment they see him, like, "Ah, there's a dreamer. So let's kill him and then we'll see what happens to his dreams." You know, as if he made these dreams happen. And the thing is, we see here that hatred in their hearts now becomes murder in their hearts. You know, this is what Jesus said to us in Mark 7, verse 21. He said, "From within, from out of the heart of men proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders." Jesus said so clearly, it's always about the heart. If you hate your brother, it's hatred, but it becomes murder in your heart. It's the same as if you would murder him. Now they're talking about murdering their own brother, and they're not even ashamed of the things that they're saying. And they're like, basically like, "We'll take care of his dreams." Again, Joseph being a picture of Jesus Christ, being a picture of the perfect son, is attacked by his brothers, and it's a picture of Satan who wants to destroy God's plans. Satan always wants to destroy God's plans. And so they're like, "Okay, let's see what happens with his dreams." And basically they're saying, "Let's see what happens to the dreams that God gave him if we kill him right here and now." Verse 21, "But Reuben heard of it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, 'Let us not kill him.'" So Reuben here, he wants to save his life. He's the oldest brother, so he feels a responsibility for his younger brother. And he's like, no, this is not right. You know, I'm going to have to give an account of my younger brother. And so he was trying to figure out a way to save his life. And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father." So he's like, "Put him in a pit. Don't you kill him. Don't get blood on your hands. Let him rather just die in this pit because he won't be able to come out. It's got sheer sides. These pits that they dug for water sometimes, you know, the rock was broken or whatever. And so the water would not be held in there. And it was just like this empty cistern or this empty pit. And he thought, "I'm going to save his life. So obviously I can go back later and maybe he's learned his lesson by then. And I can get him out and I won't be responsible for his death." So it came to pass when Joseph had come to his brothers, all this has been happening while he's still on the way. So now he gets in, he's like, "Hey, bros." And so when he comes to his brothers, that they strip Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Just like, you know, they stripped Jesus of his robe. Then they took him and cast him into the pit, and the pit was empty and there was no water in it. So you can just imagine what he must have felt. He traveled all this time to try and find him, to try and do what his father told him to do. Now he gets there and his brothers already hate him and decide they're going to put him in the pit. So they just throw him in the pit. And he must have begged and pleaded with them. And we see a bit of that later on. I'm going to show you in a little while. And then verse 25 says, "And they sat down to eat a meal." Isn't that unreal? They just, you know, they put their brother in a pit. You know, they handle him like some kind of convict, and then they go sit down for a meal and they just have fellowship together. Then they lifted their eyes and looked, and there was a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing spices, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry them down to Egypt. So here comes plan B on camels all the way. They see, maybe, you know, that's another thing. They see the Ishmaelites coming and they thought this is a great idea. And so by this time, Joseph you could say, was literally and emotionally in a hole. You know, he was just down there. Nothing made sense to him. He's like, because I think the kind of guy that Joseph was, he was just without guile. So he was like, how can someone do this to another person? How can you do this to your brother? How can you put me, this inhumane, you know, to do this to any person? Why would you do that to your brother? And I think he was just overwhelmed by all the things that's going on. You can just imagine, I don't know if they could hear him where they were sitting eating a meal, but he was probably just pleading with them and they're just like, they don't care. It's incredible. Verse 26. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Now Judah comes up with he's like, don't let us not do the dirty work. Let's give the dirty work to someone else. Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and let us not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh. And his brothers listened. Isn't that interesting? They listened to Judah instead of to Reuben. And we've already talked about the fact that Judah was really the next brother in line, because the first three brothers already disqualified themselves. Reuben disqualified himself from leading the family. Levi and Simeon disqualified themselves from leading the family. And so now Judah is really the next in line to bring the Messiah through. And you know, this is what he does. Whether his intention was to save Joseph's life, you know, by just selling him to someone, or it was, you know, just to make some money out of it, it's a speculation. We obviously don't know any of that. And then the Midianite traders passed by, so the brothers pulled Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver, and they took Joseph to Egypt. So this is also crazy. I mean, he's in the pit, he's screaming to let out, now they're picking him up. He's like, okay, finally they come to their senses, and they're like, okay, there you go. They sell him to these guys for 20 pieces of silver. Jesus was sold for 30 pieces of silver by Judas Iscariot. You know, that's that picture of Jesus Christ again. And so he was pleading with them, because the Bible tells us, and they're just ignoring him in his anguish. And for that reason, there's so much guilt later on in their lives, a lot later when they're finally in Egypt and everything is taken care of. In Genesis 42, verse 21, they said to one another, we are truly guilty concerning our brother, for we saw the anguish of his soul when he pleaded with us, and we would not hear. So there we know that he was pleading with them, like, guys, what are you doing? You know, you can't do this to me. And they just ignored him. They did not want to hear him. And the thing is, you can't get rid of your guilt. That guilt stays there, you know, and it's going to ride you. And that's what we see even at the end of their lives. They still remember this. And it says there, they sold him for 20 shekels of silver and they took Joseph to Egypt. This was already part of God's plan, because God, remember, quite a while ago when he talked to Abraham, he already told Abraham what was going to happen to his descendants. He said to him in Genesis 15, verse 13 to 14, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they'll serve, I will judge. Afterward, they shall come out with great possessions. You see, God's ways are not our ways. God already told this to Abraham such a long time ago. Now Joseph is the one. This is how God's going to do it. He's going to go to Egypt in this way. Why? You know, why would God take them out of the promised land, the land of Canaan that he promised them, and take them down to Egypt, which is a picture of the flesh, which is everything bad, really. I mean, those days, the Egyptians were the people, you know, and they knew it. Thing is, why do we always question God's working? Because God works in ways that we cannot understand. So why do we always question? Because God is sovereign, right? Is he not sovereign? He's almighty. That means he's got all the power. So if he wants to stop it, if he wants to do something else, he can do it. But the thing is, God is also omniscient. So God knows all things. God knows the future. We see like a little bit in front of us. God sees years ahead. And God knows already what he wants to do. He wants to do this for the benefit of Israel. And now he allows Joseph, in this crazy situation, to be carried away captive to this land of Egypt. There's really three reasons, if you think about that, that God allowed this. First of all, it was to wait for the iniquity of the Amorites to be completed, as he says in Genesis 15:16. You see, God's got a much bigger picture to deal with. All of us, we in our little life, and we see things from our perspective. We look at our life, we maybe look at a couple of lives around us. God sees globally, not just all the people, he sees beyond time. He's outside of time. So God is busy working out things that are far bigger and far greater. There were other nations too. And at this stage, the Amorites, they were also a pagan nation, but their guilt was not there yet. But God knew in a while, their guilt is going to be to that point where he has to judge them, and then he's going to judge them. And so there are so many things dependent upon this. Secondly, he wanted to protect Israel. At this stage, they were like 70 men. It's hardly a nation. They were much more than just Jacob, but now they were about 70 in his household. That was not a nation. So they dwelt in the midst of all these Canaanites, all these pagan nations, and so he wanted to protect them. He took them to Egypt, really, to develop them as a nation. Because at this stage, they couldn't even fill a town. But by the time 400 years after they came out of the land of Egypt, there were 600,000 males. So roughly about 2.4 million people that came out there. And then the way that God brought them out of Egypt was miraculous. So he established them worldwide, globally as a nation. They came out and he did wonders. He was their God who went before them and all the nations. Amazing how the news travels, but all the nations knew this is God's people and they were a nation now. So this is all part of God's doing, the things that we know nothing about. And, you know, Joseph was an amazing guy because he never complained and he never compromised. That's a picture of Jesus Christ. Again, think about all the things that we're going to read now that Joseph went through. And he never complained and he never compromised. James Montgomery Boyce said this. He said, he was loved and hated, favored and abused, tempted and trusted, exalted and abased, yet at no point in the 110-year life of Joseph did he ever seem to get his eyes off God or cease to trust him. Adversity did not harden his character. Prosperity did not ruin him. He was the same in private as in public. He was truly a great man. Joseph was just a great man. And God uses him as the picture, as a typology of his own son, Jesus Christ. Then Reuben returned to the pit, and indeed Joseph was not in the pit, and he tore his clothes. So he's like, plan backfired. What am I going to do now? I'm the responsible one. You know, it says in verse 30, and he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is no more. Where shall I go? I mean, where shall I go? What can I do? Because I was responsible for him. I'm the older brother. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in blood. Then they sent a tunic of many colors, and they brought it to their father and said, we have found this. Do you know whether it's your son's tunic or not? Amazing what these brothers get up to. You know, this is now their next plan. How are they going to conceal the crime that they just did? You know, so, okay, let's just make this plan, and we'll tear up his tunic. We'll put blood on it, and father will recognize this. And now, again, even though he's not Jacob anymore, he's now Israel, his sons are deceiving him still. So he's being deceived by his own sons here. And he recognized it and said, it is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. So they didn't have to say anything. And they sort of distanced themselves from that because we didn't have to lie. They just gave him the tunic. That was the lie, you know. And he made up his own mind. He said, oh man, a wild beast, surely a wild beast devoured him. He had no doubt in his mind. So to him, Joseph was dead, and he knew that a wild animal had gotten him. And Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his waist and mourned for his son many days. I mean, this was a serious mourning. And all his sons and his daughters, you see there's daughters too, we don't know all their names. They arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, for I shall go down to the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. So he refused to be comforted. He's just like, the rest of my life, I'm going to mourn about this son of mine because I loved him with everything. And isn't it amazing sometimes that God takes away something that is so super important to us? He didn't even die, but he took him away and he thought he was dead. But he couldn't be comforted, you know, and he's like, this is what I'm going to be thinking about the rest of my life. Then verse 36, now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and a captain of the guard. So, although Joseph was, you could say, the perfect choice, the picture of Jesus Christ, the interesting thing is the Messiah would not come through him. Why? in order that Jesus could fully identify with each one of us. Jesus decided the Messiah was going to, God decided the Messiah was going to be born through someone that wouldn't be perfect, through the line that of someone with just like a normal person who messes up, so that it might be by grace and not by works. That's how God chooses to save us, Ephesians 2 verse 8 and 9. So Joseph, the perfect brother, but Judah, although not being the perfect brother, he was the one that God chose to bring the Messiah through into the world, because the work of God is grace. You know, so many people look at the Old Testament and they say, oh, you know, there's no grace in the Old Testament. Let me tell you, there's a lot of grace in the Old Testament. God is a God of grace, and that's why he allows someone who's completely messing up. Now we're going to read, the next chapter is going to be about Judah's life. And you see the contrast between Judah and between Joseph. And you're thinking like, God, if I were you, I would have picked Joseph. But just like the Messiah was not born into a palace, he was born into a stable. You know, just like he didn't have this rich, abundant life. He didn't even have a place to lay his head. God chose every time to accommodate man, to meet them on their lowest level possible. Not that we have to reach up to some certain height, attain salvation, but salvation is a free gift in Jesus Christ by God's grace. So chapter 38, really about Judah, and it says there in verse 1, it came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite, whose name was Hira. So it's almost like this weird pause now. I mean, the Bible is interesting because now, you know, the story of Joseph is going to continue, but there's like this interjection in the middle of nowhere. It almost doesn't make any sense. Now he just goes on about Judah and the stuff that he said, but there was a reason for that. The thing is, it says Judah departed from his brothers. He visited this guy, and the whole idea of this visit is he dwelt there. He was part of him. And Israel's family was now really disintegrating. This is why God sent Joseph ahead to protect them, because Joseph was the faithful one. And God said, I'm going to send him ahead to Egypt so I can prepare for this nation of Israel that I want to protect. Because at this stage, the family was falling apart. Nothing was going as it's supposed to be going. Now the one a good kid who had a heart, you know, to please his father was not there anymore. Verse 2, and Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. And he married her and went into her. And so she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. So now, this Shua, her name means wealth, and she was a Canaanite woman. Just think about how much pains, you know, his forefathers went to make sure that they married, that they protected the bloodline, you know, that they went back. He sent Jacob back, you know, and so they wanted to make sure that they had the right bloodline, that they didn't just marry into the Canaanites. And now he's not even asking his father. His father's not organizing this marriage. His father's got nothing to do with the marriage. He just goes there, he sees this girl, and he says, he took her. That's basically what it literally means, he took her. It's like almost like, you know, the caveman kind of thing. He just took her. You know, it's like he saw her, he liked her, and he took her. It's crazy. No seeking God, no concern for anything else. As I said, the first three brothers, Reuben, Simeon, and Levi, already disqualified themselves. And now Judah, the next in line, he takes a wife from the Canaanites. I mean, the messianic line is supposed to go through him. And he's not got no consideration for any of this. He's not a spiritual man. And so verse 3, it says, so she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Er. So this was a Hebrew name, and it means awake. So now he has a son with her, so now this is his firstborn. Just think about that for a moment. This was an important family. Then verse 4, she conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And then she conceived yet again and bore a son and called his name Shelah. I don't think that would have gone down in Australia very well for a boy's name. But he was at Chezeb when she bore him. And so the interesting thing about Chezeb, I wonder why that's inserted there, but Chezeb means false. So all of this that he's doing here is really, it's against God's plan for him. He's not even seeking God in all of this. You know, and the other two sons, Onan and Shelah, these are Canaanite names, where Er was a Hebrew name. And you could see the influence now, you know, of now he's married to this woman, Shua, and now, you know, the first son is still a Hebrew name, but the second two sons already got Canaanite names. And you can see there's an influence there from the pagan world that he's living in. Very similar to, you know, his ancestors like Lot and those guys. Then Judah took a wife for Er, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. So, you know, that's like a Hebrew name. It's interesting to me that he now does for his son what he didn't want his father to do for him. Isn't that interesting? He now takes, Tamar means palm tree, has the idea obviously of being fruitful, that kind of thing. And so Judah did for his son what he didn't do himself. And it's amazing how sometimes we want our kids to do the right things, but then we ourselves don't do the right things. And so it's exactly a perfect illustration of that. Verse 7, but Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord killed him. I mean, the Lord puts up with a lot, you know, so I don't know how wicked this guy might have been. And that word really means evil. It doesn't tell us how the Lord killed him. It doesn't tell us what he did. It just tells us he was evil, he was wicked, and God killed him. So we don't know anything else. And it sounds harsh, but think about this. This is the messianic line. This is the family that God chose. This is the whole reason the Old Testament is written, to give us the line to the Messiah. And now he goes marry into this, and he's got a son, and this son is just acting wickedly. He's a Canaanite. And so God didn't approve of this son being the firstborn son. So verse 8, and Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother. And so this is what typically would happen. They would call it a Levirate marriage. If your brother would die before having a son, it was an obligation for the oldest remaining brother then to raise up an heir for his brother. So the only sexual part that he would have with this woman was to raise up an heir for his dead brother. So that was the reason for that. The son being born would then be named after the dead brother, and it was even incorporated into the Mosaic law later on in Deuteronomy 25, verse 5 to 6. So this was something that God gave for them to do, just because to honor that name that he made continue. And it says there, verse 9, but Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground, lest he should give an heir to his brother. So he knew that the son would not be his. I mean, it means, so this son would be considered his brother's son. And for that reason, this son would be the heir. So when he gets a son, this son would get everything and he won't get anything. So for that reason, you know, he thought like, no, this is not going to happen. And so it says he emitted on the ground. And so he was obviously, during sexual intercourse, he would just, you know, withdraw before that time. And so this has nothing to do with masturbation, by the way, or anything to do with birth control. This was rebellion. That's why God killed him. So a lot of people obviously taking this verse out of context. But the reason why God killed him was because he was rebelling against the law of God, because he refused to raise up an heir for his brother. And so he was really rebelling against God, because any rebellion against authority is really rebellion against God. And the thing which he did, it said, displeased the Lord, therefore he killed him also. So now another son killed. Evil before the Lord is what it means. And this was not just any seed, like I said, this was the descendants of Israel through Judah. So it was an important line. Verse 11, then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown, for he has said, lest he also die like his brothers. And so he's like, my other son is still too young to get married. So you just remain a widow. And then finally, when my son is grown, but he wasn't very keen, because according to him, you know, she's already killed two of my sons. You know, it's like, this woman is dangerous. You know, I've had two sons and they're both dead. And so the third one, I don't really know about that. And so Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. You know, this whole thing is just crazy, because there's no consideration of God in anything that these people do. Verse 12. Now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died, and Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. And so it doesn't seem like he mourned very long for Shua. I don't know what the mourning period was. It doesn't tell us, but it just basically says, yes, he was comforted, you know, so he was over his wife. She was probably young. They were probably young at this stage, because even Judah was probably like 40, so she must be fairly young. But he doesn't seem too troubled about the fact that she passed away. And now he goes to the sheep shearing party. It was almost like when the harvest came in for the agriculturalists, you know, they would have this big get together and celebrate the harvest. This was sort of the same kind of guys for the guy who kept the sheep. And they would go and have this time of shearing together. It would be like a big celebration. and a big party. So he goes up to that because, unfortunately, especially in this area, this big party was connected to the Canaanite pagan religions and the sexual immorality that went along with it. And so it was told Tamar, saying, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to the Timnah to shear his sheep." And so this was an opportunity for her, really. You know, verse 14, so she took off her widow's garments. I mean, she had this on forever because this kid was growing up. She covered herself with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place, which was on the way to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown and she was not given to him as wife. So this was, she was being treated wrongly according to God's command. Typically, when she went to sit, when she put on a veil and she went to sit in an open place, that's typically what the cultic or the temple prostitutes would do. It's almost similar to the Corinthians that we're reading about now in the New Testament. Is they would, that's the way a harlot would display herself. A prostitute would go sit there. And the whole idea is during this time of partying that you would celebrate by, you know, having sexual intercourse with these temple prostitutes or these cultic prostitutes. And so she went and posed as one of them. She was thinking, you know, he treated me wrong, and now she's taking the matters into her own hands and saw it as an opportunity. So when Judah saw her, he thought she was a harlot because, you know, that was typical because she had covered her face. And so he saw her, he thought she was just one of the cult prostitutes, and he turned to her by the way and said, "Please, let me come in to you," for he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. So she said, "What do you give me that you may come in to me?" So I think first of all, he didn't expect it to be her because that's crazy, right? And so he went, he just thought, "Well, I'm going to go into this prostitute," and she said, "What will you give me? So you got to pay first, you know, let's make the deal first, and then we'll talk about the rest." And he said, "I will send a young goat from the flock." So she said, "Will you give me a pledge till you send it?" So it's great saying that you're going to give me a goat, but what do I get in the meantime to know that your word is going to be true, that you're going to give me this goat? Then he said, what pledge shall I give you?" So she said, "Your signet and cord and your staff that is in your hand." You know, so triple security. The cord is like the thing that he would wear around his neck. The signet would be his family seal. It would be like a ring. It will be like his family seal. And the staff probably had like kind of a head or a carving that specifically marked it as belonging to him. So everyone would know his cord, his signet, and his staff would be Judas. You know, there's something that would identify him. So she was like taking all that as security. And it says he gave them to her. And he went into her, and she conceived by him. So this is really what she hoped for. And I think more than that, this was part of God's plan. Because he was on his own mission. He married this Canaanite woman, and he was going to have sons by her, and then the bloodline would have to go through them. But this was part of the way that God worked it out eventually, that now he's going to have a child through Tamar, and the line is going to be different, the direct family line of the Messiah. It's obviously better than being from the Canaanites around them. Verse 19, so she arose and went away and laid aside a veil and put on the garments of a widowhood. So back into mask on again. Verse 20, and Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend the Adullamite to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, but he did not find her. So he doesn't even obviously go himself. He sends someone by the hand of his friend. So maybe his friend or his friend's servant or whatever. Verse 21, then he asked the men of that place, saying, "Where is the harlot who was openly by the roadside?" And they said, "There's no harlot in this place." So he goes, he goes to look for her. And they said, "Well, there's never been someone like that over here." Big problem. So he returned to Judah and said, "I cannot find her." Also, the men of the place said, "There was no harlot in the place." And so now it's like, well, what do we do now? You know, there's never been a prostitute here. He says, verse 23, "Let her take them for herself, lest we be shamed, for I sent this young goat and you have not found her." So now suddenly he's worried about his reputation. It's quite amazing, but it's like, okay, let's not, this is an issue, but let her just take it, and unless we come to any shame in that. And it came to pass about 3 months after that Judah was told, saying, "Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry." So Judah said, "Bring her out and let her be burnt." Isn't that crazy? He's a hypocrite. He goes out and there's no issue with that, but now he found out she got a child illegitimately and he's like, burn her, you know. This whole burning was later incorporated also in the Mosaic law in Leviticus 21 verse 9, and also the more common one would be stoning, Deuteronomy 22 verse 24. But the thing for him, the whole issue with Tamar was a total uncomfortable issue, because he already knew that he owed her a son. He said that, and that was the right thing to do according to the law, so he should have given her a husband already, and he knew he was old enough, but he had two sons who died, and so this was a really uncomfortable issue for him, and now he's like, okay, let's burn her, let's get, you know, let's just sort of get the issue out of the way, it's not a problem anymore, then, you know, so that's probably part of what he thought. So he's just not a great guy. Verse 25. When she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, by the man to whom these belong, I am with child. And she said, please determine whose these are, the signet and the cord and the staff. So here's the time to present the evidence. Exhibit A. And she brings it out. And this was sort of a big thing, because I think when someone would be burnt, there's a lot of people involved, you know. So he thought, let's just like, you know, put it away quietly. He doesn't want to be shamed, but now this is huge shame on her. She's being brought out, and she said, you know, it just shows you what a hypocrite he is, because he knew he was wrong, you know. And so they bring her out, and she says, whose are these? So verse 26, Judah acknowledged him. I don't think he had a choice, because everyone knew it was his. So Judah acknowledged them and said, she has been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah, my son, and he never knew her again. Incredible how you can look at yourself, you know, how you can look at someone else's sin and see it as so bad. You look at your own sin, it's like, no, it's not so bad. He doesn't say, no, I'm even worse than her. He says it the other way around. You know, she's more righteous than I. I'm righteous, but she's even more righteous than I. I'm like, you are completely bad, dude. It's like so bad, because I did not give it to Shelah. He knew that he was wrong. And then he never knew her again. The thing is, when he had sex with her, when he saw her against on the road, you know, it was for his own pleasure. That was the only reason. When she engaged in sex with him, it was to raise up an heir for a dead husband. It was the right thing to do. That's what she did. She didn't do it for her selfish reasons. It was the right thing to do. But he, and that's why he says, you know, she was more righteous than I. Verse 27, now it came to pass at the time for giving birth that, behold, twins were in a womb. So now these twins. And so it was when she was giving birth that the one put out his hand, and the midwife took a scarlet thread and bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. So interesting, this was twins being born, you know, and so the first one puts out his hand and she just ties this red thread around his hand to know which one came out first. And then it happened as he drew back his hand that his brother came out unexpectedly. And she said, how did you break through? This breach be upon you. So it must have been a breech birth. I don't know. Oftentimes when twins are being born, you know, they are sort of like both sides. So a breech is sort of something that's possible. Therefore, his name was called Perez. That means breech. So it's like, this is you. Because it's quite amazing. A breech birth is obviously a serious, difficult birth. And so the hand goes out of the one. He pulls it back, and then suddenly the other one gets birthed in a breech position. It's like incredible. She's like, how did you do that? How did you break through? So they called him Breach. This poor kid, the rest of his life would be called Breach. Afterward, his brother came out who had the scarlet thread on his hand, and his name was called Zerah. So again, interesting the story that happens here. But in Luke 3 and Matthew chapter 1, we get the genealogy of Jesus Christ. Four women are being mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. And the first one is Tamar. Tamar, a lady we read, she played a prostitute. The second lady mentioned in this genealogy is Rahab. She was a professional prostitute. Ruth was a Moabitess, and Bathsheba, we all know, she was, you know, the one committing adultery with David. So these are the four women that's in the line of Jesus Christ, in the Messianic line. It's incredible to me. You know, four unlikely candidates to bring the Savior into the world. We read in Ruth, in the book of Ruth, verse 18 to 22, it says, now this is the genealogy of Perez. This Perez that we're reading about here. Perez begot Hezron, Hezron begot Ram, Ram begot Aminadab, Aminadab begot Nashon, Nahshon begot Salmon, Salmon begot Boaz, Boaz begot Obed, Obed begot Jesse, and Jesse begot David. So this was directly in line. This is how God worked it out. No Canaanites in here, but Tamar, you know, was in this line of Jesus Christ. Incredible to me. And this is why I think this whole story, why God puts it like this, we have the one picture on the one side of Joseph being this perfect son. You know, everything he did was right, and he was an illustration of Jesus Christ. But then Jesus came for everyone. And that's why when he came into the world, he came through a line like Judah. He came through a person like Tamar, just so that he's not like so far out and holy that, you know, no one could come near. He came to relate to man at the lowest level. And that's why the story is in the biblical record, because the messianic line came through him. And it just shows us that there's unbelievable grace in the Old Testament. I mean, even from that time, God wanted to save the world. And no one, he could not relate to anyone. If he just came as this holy, perfect king, he had to come in the way that the world, that he could relate to the world. And so for our sakes, it says he became poor. And what a beautiful picture we have here, you know, even in the Old Testament.